This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Scotland Outdoors podcast with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this. I'm Mark Stephen, she's Rachel Stewart. As you probably know, we build the Scotland Outdoors podcast from a live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors.
And everywhere we went, it was raining. So have fun listening to us getting very, very wet.
Out of Doors with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
Isn't that a lovely sound? The robins are singing in the dark. It's really mild this morning too. Can't see any stars because there's high cloud this morning. But I'm Mark Stephen. I'm standing here in the car park at Beechgrove in Aberdeen, sitting the other side of the fire. Rachel Stewart.
It is incredibly mild. I think it's 9 degrees, which feels really mild for this time of year. I think visually you can see that the season is beginning to change. You know, we're losing all those lovely oranges and reds. But it doesn't feel like winter's just around the corner, does it?
No, not at all. I was on the M8 yesterday and I passed a tree, which obviously, because I was on the M8, I couldn't stop. You know, it's when you come on to the M8, you know, from the Stirling direction. There's a tree there which kind of sticks up across the top of the parapet and it's in full leaf and I've no idea what it is. I didn't recognise it at all.
And of course we want to hear what you're up to today. I actually thought it was really busy driving in, and normally there's not another soul in the road.
No.
So if you've got busy plans this weekend, if you're out and about in the Scottish countryside, do get in touch with us. Let us know what you're up to. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us, as Mark said, 80295, and give us a call as well. 08085 92 and it's Finn here this morning taking your calls.
His last day today.
It is. He's escaping.
He's off to the Oban Times.
Very
past, nice. Pastures new, lovely place to work too.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah. Let's start off with an email which made some members of the team chuckle, not me obviously. It's entitled Lovely New Photograph of Presenters and comes from Holly Gibb in Auchendinny. She says, I've enjoyed listening to Out of Doors every Saturday for the past 3 years, although I've never listened live. I do listen on Saturday on BBC Sounds while pottering about my house or on my way to some outdoor adventure. I was delighted to see in the app a couple of weeks ago a lovely new photograph of Rachel and Mark, although utterly shocked that all this time I thought Mark was you and Ewan was Mark. What are you laughing at?
There's just so much I could say. But Holly continues, I think what I first loved hearing on this programme was the crackling fire. You really do bring the best of the outdoors to our imaginations. Keep up the great work. Highlight of my weekend, she says. And that's Holly in Auchendinny. This is the ant and deck scenario, isn't it, Mark? No one can tell one from the other.
Be careful. You're treading on very thin ice there. I could have sworn blind there while we were talking that I heard a fox bark.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I think so. We used to get them regularly in the car park here, but I haven't seen them in a while.
Let's try to change the subject. We've got a mystery sound for you again this week. Would you like to have a listen?
Go for it. Something else being strangled.
It sounds like Mark standing on the tail of something.
Yeah.
If you know what it is, get in touch. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us 80295 and give Finn a call 08085 92 95 00.
As we discussed at length quite recently on this programme, you know, rewilding is one of those terms that's, you know, how long's a piece of string? It means different things to different people. For most people, however, you associate it with sort of remote areas, you know, it's somewhere out in the country.
Absolutely. And Rewilding Denmark Field is a bit different to that, because it's in the next few years, it thinks that it will be surrounded by new housing developments, which will land it in the middle of an urban sprawl just beside Perth. I've been talking to ecologist at the project, Ellie Corsi, who says they've been striving to include the wider community in their vision from the very start.
So we've got an area of land that the landowner, the private landowner, has very generously decided to kind of dedicate to the local community for a community growing project. So we're planning to have 49 allotment plots here. And just a couple of weeks ago, we got planning permission through for that. So yeah, we're really excited to hopefully start building those allotment plots soon.
Now, you see community involvement as something that's really crucial to the future of this rewilding project. Explain why that's the case.
Our location for a rewilding project is quite unique. We're not sort of in the highlands in the middle of nowhere with very few people around us. We are kind of sandwiched between the city of Perth and a little village called Lunkerty. And in the next 2 decades, we're actually going to basically be engulfed into the city of Perth by 2 really big housing developments. So we are going to be a rewilding project within the outskirts of a city, and it comes along with lots of challenges with all of those people living all around the site, but also lots of opportunities to provide a refuge for wildlife within a city, provide green space for people, and also provides an environmental education opportunity to kind of connect people to their local wildlife and the rewilding movement in general.
We're walking along one of your fields just now, overlooking the River Tay. It's a bit of a miserable day, so we're not seeing it in its full glory, are we?
But no, definitely not.
Explain what you're doing here. What are the main projects that you've been tackling since this project got going a little over a year ago?
Yeah, so the project started just over a year and a half ago. At the very beginning of the project, the main purpose was to convert these ex-arable fields. So we've got about 90 acres and it's all ex-arable land. And the owners of this land really wanted to dedicate it to natural habitats for the climate and for biodiversity. But as we've gone along and the kind of reality of all of the developments that are happening around the site have become recognised, our kind of scope of the project has expanded quite a lot. It's kind of grown arms and legs that we didn't know were going to grow right at the beginning, and we're now focusing a lot on providing outputs for the local community and trying to take the local community along with us on this journey and engage them as much as possible.
So practically speaking, what have you been doing, and I suppose crucially not doing here?
There's no arable farming happening, or intensive arable farming happening on this land now. So we are taking quite a hands-off approach to rewilding. Across the vast majority of the area, we're just letting natural vegetation succession take place and allowing natural habitats to sort of establish by themselves.
We've got a good example just to the right of us, because we have a field that's completely covered in arable weeds.
Yes, basically. Yeah, so because we're not doing anything too kind of interventional across the vast majority of the area, we're just kind of letting it rewild in its own time. We knew that these fields would become dominated by what people call arable weeds for the first sort of 5-6 years or so. And that has happened in this field next to us within only 1 growing season. And a lot of people kind of demonize these plants because we call them arable weeds, but they're all native plant species, which are just species that really love disturbed, nutrient-enriched ground. But they all do have a value to biodiversity and to...
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Yeah. What benefits do they bring?
In the field to our right, it's only had 1 growing season. So a lot of the plants that have come up are kind of more delicate flowering plants. And they have been amazing for butterflies and bees. And then in the other field in front of the house, which has been rewilding for two growing seasons, that's been kind of dominated by woody arable weeds like docks, for example. And they aren't as good for pollinators, but docks are absolutely amazing for providing cover. They've got these really broad, dark leaves that trap moisture. So we've got loads of toads and frogs in that field. And then they've got these really tall, woody flowering stems, and birds love to find cover and shelter in there. And things like insects like spiders absolutely love building their webs between these woody stems. So they may not be kind of everybody's favourite plants, but they are native plants that our wildlife have evolved with for many generations, and so they do have a biodiversity benefit.
What's the long-term plan for here then? What do you want it to look like in the future?
Most of our site is actually on what would have been the floodplain of the Tay. So this area would have received a lot of disturbance from flood events from the Tay, and also from big roaming herds of large mammals kind of sweeping through the fertile lowlands. That would have created a lot of disturbance and maintained a very open, kind of dynamic habitat. So in the lower parts of this site, that's exactly what we want to try and recreate as much as possible, a kind of mosaic of grassland, kind of thorny thicket and scrub, and a kind of peppering of mature trees as well, and some little pockets of woodland. And by providing all those successional stages of vegetation, we'll hopefully be able to maximise the number of habitats here and therefore maximise our biodiversity potential for the site.
We've got more from Denmark Field coming up shortly. Where are they building the houses in relation to this?
They're building it just a bit further up, so they're saying that in the future the houses will come right up to where they are. In fact, it'll really encroach on them, and that's why they've had to have so much community involvement here. Mm-hmm. They think that if they get volunteers from the local area involved, they'll be invested in it, and you know, they'll take an active interest, you know, from now on in. And it's just off the A9. Do you know where the site is? It's just off the A9 on the way to Lunkerty. So it's in quite a central position, you know. You
it's just when he mentioned, when she mentioned the River Tay floodplain, I thought,
yeah, yeah, that confused you a bit there.
Yeah.
But they are really active in the local area. They get a lot of school children out planting trees, and they say that they've had huge amounts of interest, actually, from all over Scotland, but particularly, obviously, near Perth, where the local community lives.
One of my neighbours, No Names No Patrol, has been pioneering this whole field choked with docks, you know, approach to nature.
Yeah.
It's not going to go down well, farmers. It really isn't.
Yeah, they may not see the benefit of it yet.
Not immediately. Burnbacks Village lies just south of Aberdeen. Now, it's a hamlet, really. It consists of around 20-odd houses, and it just overlooks the North Sea. Blink and you kind of miss it. The village is in a very chequered past, with it being completely abandoned in the 1980s. Now, Joe McLeod's been a resident in the village for the last 30 years, and he's been delving into his history. I met Joe on, it wasn't blustery, it was an extremely stormy day, with a wind straight off the North Sea blasting into our faces.
The last few days with the storms at the end of last week, if you can see a wave from our house, you know it's massive. Mm-hmm. And we're so fortunate here, you have that one day, 2 days' time we'll have beautiful sunny weather.
Yeah. We've just crossed the railway line, if we head back across this way. Essentially, at one stage, it was completely derelict. The phrase ghost town sounds a bit overdramatic, but that's what it was.
It was. There was quite a lot of the articles in the press at the time called it a ghost town. There were 140 people here at its peak, with only 22 houses. And it was down to one house, one person, and she was living on her own for quite some time. So you're right, every one of these houses, the roofs were off, there was vandalism, arson, and it was derelict for about 10, 15 years. But even before that, it had been, some of the houses had been destroyed for about 70 years.
How do you go about finding the stories? Because it is a broad range of stuff. I mean, multiple deaths on the railway lines, multiple deaths on the cliffs and things, multiple suicides. You'd think this would be a quiet haven.
The British newspaper archive, I couldn't have done it without that website. It's just fantastic. You think a small village. It's not going to feature in the press a lot, but it does. Hundreds of returns from the British newspaper archive. From that, you've got Scotland's people, where you get the birth, marriage and death certificates, census returns, and valuation rolls. That must sound really dull, that you're fighting through all these statistics. But you see a pattern. The stories come out from those things. So I've really enjoyed searching for all this stuff.
There's one story about, again, related to the railway line, about an engine driver, you know, who's coming down this track. Now, he must have done it hundreds of times before and somehow manages to get himself killed.
Yeah, he was going into Aberdeen. So this is about 3-4 miles from Aberdeen station. And he's doing a little bit of maintenance, hopping up on his engine. And his plateman misses, knows he's missing, stops the train, and then the backed up and found him here. He struck the bridge, and you can imagine it's an instantaneous death for the poor man. And this is like 20 feet from where we are standing just now.
So essentially he was standing on top of the, you know, the coal tender, trying to sort something out.
Yeah.
His mind must have been completely elsewhere when he hit the bridge parapet.
They know the line, of course they do, and to forget for that moment that there's a bridge coming up, and it resulted in the poor man dying.
Yeah. Just extraordinary. And as a community, how was this rebuilt? How did it come back into being again?
There was several attempts to resurrect it. I think one of the early ones was in the 1980s to refurbish the buildings. But it was Scotia Homes that got it going. 1990, they were putting in planning applications, and they got a lot of support from the council to progress with it. If it was today, I fear that this place, it wouldn't have happened. They would just knock it down and make some hideous flats like that lot over there.
Other opinions are available, but not currently. No, does it work as a community, or is it just one of these wee dormitory places where, you know, people come to sleep and then go somewhere else to work?
Not at all. Most of us get on with one another. We have quite a few social events through the year. Hogmanay is really good, I feel, here that... We come out for the bells, you can hear the ship's horns going off.
And in Aberdeen Harbour?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow. And so then you do a bit of first footing afterwards, old style ones, we're going round the houses, knocking on the doors. And no, I really enjoy living here. Most of us get on. Yeah.
There are some fabulous photographs in your book, and at the very end of the book, you've got a section that says, you know, my favourite photograph. Describe it to me and tell me why.
Right, okay, it's a photograph of a woman called Dorothy Beattie. She was born in the village, that house over there, and it's a photograph of her on a push bike. It's not a great photograph, it's blurred, it's quite grainy, but it says everything about the village for me. You can see derelict houses behind, there's a fit young girl on her bike, there's the water supply for parts of the village. It was taken from a well, put in a barrel, and distributed with stainless steel buckets. And it just tells you everything about the village, that here I am, I'm young and I'm fit and I love living here. This place had dry toilets out the back. Aye. And it was a bucket with sand. They were healthy. Aye. And it was well ventilated.
You'd have to stand in this window to understand why that's quite so funny.
No need for extractor fans.
No, absolutely not. It's just one last question. I mean, I have an old book about my village, White Rashes, and it was probably written about 25, 30 years ago. I find it fascinating, but I wasn't born in White Rashes. I wasn't raised in White Rashes. Why do people get so interested in this kind of thing?
The stories, it's the sort of thing that you hear from your grandparents. And I think we miss these older generations telling the stories that quite a few times I would have loved to have spoken to someone from the village. Have we lost the art of storytelling? I don't know. It's something that you love to hear about how times were different. And one thing that struck me when I was doing this research, you would come out and you're reading all these stories. These happened right here. They didn't happen in some far off place where you're studying history. These stories happened in our houses, in our doorsteps. And I've got a whole list of people that have lived in my house since 1910, and these people walked our street, and that's what I think we find fascinating. I mean, the quality of the photographs, I've been so fortunate to get some great photographs. Aberdeen Journals are just a fantastic resource for old photographs, and we were just so pleased at the quality of the stuff that we were able to find.
Joe McLeod, and Joe's book,
Burnbanks Village is available now. You can find it online or whatever. There's Kindle editions, there's all sorts of things. But it's fascinating photographs contained within it. But boy, it was blowing a hoolie that day.
I bet it was. Mm-hmm. It is fascinating. And I think people really love finding out about their local area. And there's nothing I like better than searching through archive newspapers and seeing old black and white photographs. Fantastic.
Couldn't agree more. You're listening to BBC Radio Scotland. This is Out of Doors. I'm Mark Stephen. She's Rachel Stewart. Coming up, the aftermath of last week's storms for one Deeside farm and the unintended consequences of tree planting for one rare butterfly.
Yeah, and we've got a mystery sound for you today as well. Will we have another listen? I wonder if there are cats all over the country wondering what's
also
going
wincing.
On here.
Yeah. Connor in Bristol reckons it's a wood pigeon after landing on the car windscreen and bending the wipers so they squeal like that. Connor, I like the way your mind works. Keith near Camry says, might the tree in full leaf in the M8 be one of the Wi-Fi masts disguised as a tree? No, it's not, Keith. It was in the wrong place. This was actually near the big gasometer, near the centre of Glasgow. He says there are a couple near the big roundabout at Dunblane. And he reckons the mystery sound might be a distressed rabbit.
Oh, no. All wrong.
Yeah, no, that I know exactly what he's talking about there. Shehalion in Perthshire is one of Scotland's most popular... Is it a Munro?
I
thought it was slightly lower. Over the years, its slopes have suffered from overgrazing, but a move is now afoot to re-establish the natural scrub in a project called Landscape Learn.
Yeah, Modstart travelled to meet those behind this idea, landscape architects Joanna Gibbons and Neil Davidson, and Izzy Filer of the John Muir Trust. Now, they met on the slopes of the Fairy Mountain, and it wasn't long before they got talking about Shehalion's fascinating history.
What we wanted to do was really focus in on making that connection with young people, and then for that to become really meaningful for them in terms of establishing montane habitats, which are very dispersed, very fragmented, and impoverished.
I would say that as a result of the start of the Seed to Tree project at Shehalion, we are now looking at kind of rolling it out as a project on different sites that we manage and seeing how we can get community growers involved and get more people collecting local seed and growing it on themselves. So it has potentially kick-started bigger projects.
Yeah, that's the point, isn't it? That's the beauty of it. It's from seed, and that has many beautiful sort of connotations, that it's kind of like a starting point, and it's very optimistic, isn't it, all the energy that's contained in a seed. And there's a lot of science around that seed, like where it comes from, who collects it. You've got to be able to identify that seed very, very specifically and then make sure that you understand the place where that seed is going to be grown on and planted into a little tree or a little scrubby bush to make sure that that is the right place for it. You know, the microclimate's right, the soil's right, and the genetics of that seed contained in that little seed is going to give it the best chance to be able to contribute to habitat restoration. So there's a lot of art, there's a lot of science, there's a lot of social networking, a lot of different skills involved.
It's quite symbolic that you say that this is the starting point, this is the seed, and it's happening here at Shehalion, which has been the seed for so much magic and mystery and science. And Neil, I know you're a good person to talk to about this, because this place where we're standing has a real cultural significance, scientific significance. Can you tell me a bit about that, and does that link at all to the reason why you've isolated this place?
I think Shehalion is special for a lot of people, and again, as landscape architects, we spend most of our life designing landscapes and contours and working out levels and all those sorts of things, and it's just fascinating to us to think that Shehalion was the place that contours were invented. And the reason they were invented was because of a scientific experiment in 1774, which was carried out by the Royal Astronomer at the time, and he used Shehalion to calibrate the gravitational pull of the mountain to then try and extrapolate that to work out the mass of the Earth, so how heavy the Earth was, and ultimately then to think about how heavy the Sun was and all of the other planets. So it was a really fundamentally important project in terms of, at that time, thinking about, you know, the planet we live on. And this is, I guess, is something that really resonates with us, because all of our work now is thinking about legacy and in that sense, we mean legacy for people who come to visit places and being interested and then suddenly thinking, actually, maybe I can make a difference, and picking up those ideas, maybe choosing to have a career in landscape and environment as opposed to something else. And we're doing a project at the Natural History Museum at the moment called the Urban Nature Project, and they describe it in a way that I think is really interesting. They talk about young people visiting becoming planetary ambassadors, so really being interested in climate change and biodiversity and thinking we can make a difference. And that, I think that to us is really the most important thing of a project like this, is trying to encourage young people to get involved. But it's just this whole legacy of science and learning that this mountain has kind of had for 200 odd years. And then, of course, alongside that, there's the whole sort of the folklore that comes with the mountain. It's the fairy hill of the Caledonians. There is, you know, reportedly sort of little caves and things where giants lived and witches lived and fairies lived. And you know, that's just amazing. There's something for everyone here. And I think when we were talking with the John Muir Trust originally, that kind of, when this became an option to kind of collaborate on, we just like immediately put our hand up and said, yes, please, because it's an amazing, special place.
It's the entrance to the underworld, so I'm told.
That's right.
Not that I've ever found it, but one day.
It's out there.
I was wondering, because there are documents that describe pretty much exactly how you would enter that underworld. I don't know if I would ever dare. I'm quite a musical person, and I was wondering if you guys were as well, because I know that if you're a musical person, the fairies want you even more than you might.
Well, there's an interesting story about music. When they were doing their experiment on the mountain to work out the mass of the mountain, the gravitational pull, they were camped up here for 6 months. I think it basically bankrupted the Royal Society when they did it. They spent so much money. And they were camped on the north and south side of the mountain, so on the kind of the sort of equal distance, so they could measure the stars and measure the deflection in this little plumb line that they used. And one of the camps had somebody who played the fiddle, and he was like really excellent fiddle player. But when they were finishing up, the camp burnt down, so he was gifted a Stradivarius as a thank you to replace his little handmade fiddle, which I think is just another. So there's all these little stories and narratives about this place are really fascinating.
How do you measure the weight of the earth, the sun, the moon and all our neighbours? Just an only lonely mountain and tricks of scientific labour. Animals run untied. How do you measure the weight of the earth, the fairy hill of Caledonia?
Habitat restoration has got to be one of the most critical activities right now. If we're talking about this kind of planetary view, planetary health, whatever you want to call it, it's trying to encourage, which comes from every geologist knows this, the connectivity between all our land masses. It all goes back to one eons ago. So, you know, that sense of an impact in one place having an impact somewhere else, the fact that we are all connected, I think is really important, and that any kind of habitat restoration anywhere is going to contribute. And we must feel that that is the output, because otherwise the whole climate change and biodiversity loss crisis becomes so enormous that you can see people reeling back, not wanting to talk about it, because they really don't know where to start.
Johanna Gibbons, Neil Davidson and Izzy Filer. And you can hear more of the Landscape Learn project on the Scotland Outdoors podcast, available on BBC Sounds. Now, Rachel Stewart will explain how the Astronomer Royal Maskelyne calculated the mass of the Earth using a plumb line and a Stradivarius fiddle.
I hope that you've all got pen and paper there so that we can get into this formula. You actually say you made a programme all about this, so I think you're the expert.
Yeah, no, I was, as I said to you, if I could remember a tenth of what we've done, you know, I would be an absolute genius. It's a very clever way. They came in remarkably close to the actual mass of the, you know, the weight of the Earth. You know, it's just a really clever idea. I think what they forgot to do was to calculate the gravitational pull from surrounding mountains, but I said it's probably not the right time in the morning to go in that kind of scientific
detail. No, it's too much.
You wouldn't understand.
Well, I wouldn't. It pickles my brain. I kid you not. It's way beyond me.
Yeah. Anyway,
Coming up, we've got the effect of flooding on our rivers and cycling adventures from the 1930s.
Yeah, we also have a mystery sound for you this morning. We'll have a listen.
Quite distressing.
It's a bit, isn't it? It's not the most pleasant. Yeah. We've had a few wrong answers. Daniel's been in touch to say, is it a distressed rabbit? No. Mm-hmm. Neil Caldwell in Larg says, morning, would the mystery sound be someone rubbing a balloon on their jumper to stick it to a wall?
It's no end of the fun in Neil Caldwell's life, is it?
I know. To stick it to a wall with static electricity. I like that. He says it's either that or a fox. Love the show.
This came in from Alistair Nergan, says, I guess it's a young stoat or weasel. Glad to be wrong again. Well, I'm glad you're glad, Alistair, because you are. Mrs. M and I are heading west today, Carmel and Tobermory, for a few days late autumn sun. We can dream. You never know. You might hit lucky. And Derek, listening in fourth, says, is today's mystery sound a grey squirrel? Not sure if red squirrels make the same sound. Again, close.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very close.
Yep.
You may recall, Rachel and I were sitting here at this very... Well, it wasn't the self-sized spot, it was about 3 feet that way. And we were trying to get into reception. But we were drooking last week. I mean, it was really heavy rain last weekend. By that point, rivers in the northeast had burst their banks and the damage was becoming really evident. Farmer Jane McInnes lives on the banks of the River Dee at Merikuta, so she's seen flooding, you know, more times than I've had hot dinners. I went to talk to her to check out what she was facing this time round.
Well, what we're doing, what we've been doing this morning, is we're clearing some of the debris. We haven't done this corner yet. You can see all the debris, all the wood that gathers on the fencing, and some of this deer fencing is leaning badly. The fence is coming tomorrow. We'll probably take those posts out and realign them, but the wire here is still good. Because it was all put up after Storm Frank, which wasn't that long ago.
No, not terribly. And if we actually just look, basically, downstream there, there's still pretty extensive flooding.
Oh, yes, right. We can't even get to the far end, because I go right down to the bridge there, and we can't even get there. We've managed to patch up a wee bit where those horses are. The top bit's all OK. But if you look... You can't see it here. You can actually see a sort of rim.
About a bit, here?
Yeah, where it comes up to.
Which was basically, that would be, what, about 250 metres from the river?
Yeah, something like that. The fence down there, there's a line, that's completely gone. That was an electric fence. All the fencing right round the river's gone. But after Storm Frank, I did away with Rylock and went for electric. Uh-huh. So it's not gathered the same rubbish.
Yeah.
And the wires can be put back, the posts are a bit further apart and electric, so that'll be quite easily put back together again. But, I mean, you just have to look at that fence there, and that's even not a deer fence.
What's that lying in the field there? It looks like sand.
Well, we haven't got that far yet, but we think it's sand.
We think it's sand.
I'll tell you what we did find. You better not report it. Up in the water there, two very large salmon.
Really?
Really?
Wow.
And I'm not joking. Deed. They were deed.
Deed.
But no, we haven't got... The two more fields on, we haven't got beyond there.
Yeah.
At all. But we were lucky. We got... I always have contingency plans for flooding.
I wanted to ask you about that, because how long have you actually been at this farm?
I've been here since 1969.
So you've seen lots of flooding here?
I have seen, but it is getting more regular.
Yeah.
There's no question about it. But the strange thing about this was... Last time it came in on the banking over there, because there's a big corner there, the big bend, and it wrecked all that lot. Well, that has virtually held. It's damaged, but it's held. But what's happened this year, and it's really odd, because I follow SEPA and the water levels. The water level was higher at Garth Dee by far than it was at Mar Lodge. Now, quite often when we get a flood, it's a snow melt up in the hills. And we know it's coming this way. Well, it started trickling in here, just down where that fence has gone there. Because we went down and we saw it coming. We thought, oh, well, we're used to that. Before we even knew what, it was coming from here. Now, as you know, there's been very strong south-easterly winds. And when they saw the water coming in here, you could see it's like little waves being blown this way.
So basically, it's coming from the sea?
Yeah.
How far from the sea are you here?
I don't know, 8-10 miles, something like that, into Aberdeen.
Wow.
And all that's flooded. Lady down there, her house is flooded for the second time. It was in Stormfront.
I mean, I'm sure you can't spend you're too busy to spend your entire life watching what SEPA are saying. So when do your antenna start to twitch? What makes you nervous?
When the water gets high at Park. It just actually SEPA saves me from running up and down to the flipping river about four times a day. But what was so good about this was I had 300 sheep on the place. And we got the ones that were down here, we got them off 2 days. And then the day before it happened, they're not my sheep, but he and I spoke the afternoon before it happened and he got them off. We got the deer up to high ground, and then because we can chuck some in there, because we didn't know what was going to happen. We had all the horses in, and I only got the cattle in the day before, but we were planning to get them in anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, sheep don't swim. Deer do.
Right, okay.
And deer can swim really well, so when we've had odd bits of flooding before, the deer will go and wallow in it because they just absolutely love it. And I've had, years ago, I had 9 deer got out and they crossed the river. And I thought,
fun getting them back.
Well, there's two things with deer: patience and persuasion.
Uh-huh.
Persuasion is the great thing when you've got a bucket that you rattle.
Yeah.
And there was one of the older ones, and she looked at me, and she looked at me, and walked up and down, and walked up. And eventually she couldn't resist it. She got in. She got swept down a bit, and then everyone followed her, and it was like synchronized swimming.
Hang on. The deer were on one side of the river,
yes.
And you were rattling a bucket, yes. On the other side of the river.
And they swam. And when they got in, they got... It wasn't in a flood. It wasn't in a flood. It was normal.
No.
And they actually got swept downstream, and as soon as they got out of that current, they came back towards me.
Yeah.
So I didn't say a word to them. I just kept walking with the bucket till I got them back into a field.
Things like the fencing, if you're having to replace... I mean, you're saying you get rid of the Rylock fencing and things, the big square fencing. Who pays for that?
Me.
Can you insure it?
Nope. I did get some help from last time, Stormfront, it was something to do with the Scottish Government. We did get a little bit of help. And also, when the banks go, they're full of stone. So these fields were just a mess of stone, which they had to spend ages with diggers just trying to... I mean, too many to pick up by hand. But all the gorse and stuff has grown onto there now, and that also helps to stabilise the bank a bit, you know?
If this is becoming more regular, though, Jane, you know, which obviously is the case in your experience...
Yeah.
What's it going to mean for the people that are trying to live beside the river?
Well, it's funny, you and I were talking about, you know, say how lovely it is to live beside a river 99% of the time, but that 1%, it's hell. It really is.
I mean, scary.
Oh, it's the speed of the river, it's scary. There's no way to get out of that. It's scary. The speed that it was coming along here with those winds, and to see, it wasn't just floating in, you could see it moving.
Mm-hmm.
Moving this way. Well, I've never seen that before because it's always all coming from here. But you just look at that. So what do you do? Is this global warming? What is it? We don't know.
Jane McInnes on her farm on the banks of Dee, and Jane was saying too that the last big storm event they had several hundred haylage bales, you know, wrapped bales and what have you, which basically got swept away. And they were watching them just going round like corks, you know, heading out through a sort of plug hole in a bath or something.
Why?
Like that. And they ended up in the woods and they had to go and retrieve them all and what have you.
So. That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think one of the, you know, the images of the flooding from 2015 was the mobile caravan, the mobile home being swept down the Dee and then crashing into the bridge. It was incredible scenes.
Yeah, there was lots of that. I remember driving down the river and seeing lots of caravans at the side because they kind of washed out the caravan park at Ballater.
Yeah.
It's pretty clear the impact of the flooding on the land, but how does flooding like that impact the river? Now, here to offer some welcome insight is Dr. Lorraine Hawkins of the River Dee Trust. Thanks for joining us, Lorraine.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, no problem at all. What Jane was saying there, and I absolutely take her word on this, that she thought the flooding was actually coming from the sea end. It was coming up the river. Could that be the case?
Well, I actually don't know what the tide was, but yes, whether it was a high tide or a low tide, when the peak flood water was coming down, will have had an impact in the lower river, yes.
Yeah. It was high tide and it's 8 miles inland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the tidal limit is basically at Robert Gordon's University, so it's quite a way inland.
Yeah. Interesting.
So we know what the impact is on the land when we see that kind of flooding, but what about the impact on the river itself?
Yeah, well, the river is designed to have floods, but as your previous person was saying, you know, it seems that these floods are getting more frequent and more severe, and that's exactly what is expected in climate change. And in fact, I think climate change is here and we're having to cope right now. So the river, you know, got a lot of water from the surrounding land very quickly, not able to cope with that all, and it starts to spill out. You know, where it would like to spill out is the natural floodplains, but when floodplains aren't accessible, it spills out in any areas it can do, and really does create us a problem as well.
The solution once upon a time was to sort of build flood defences down the side of the river, to basically trying to contain it, to canalise it. That's no longer the sort of, you know, the received wisdom. You know, they want the water to spread out, but of course folk are living where it's spreading out sometimes now.
Yeah, and that is a real challenge for us. You know, we need the land to be able to hold this water and release it back slowly into the river. But with all the building and construction on the land, there is a lot less opportunities for the land to hold water. We need to focus on the areas where it is possible for water to be held on the land. And, you know, the River Dee has a large upper catchment, for example, and there are areas which could be returned to floodplains. We are also able to remove some of the flood embankments and the levees that are created, and there is some work going on right now up at Mar Lodge in the upper catchment with the Cairngorms National Park Authority to remove a very big flood embankment and allow, you know, the floodplain to be reconnected to the river once more. So that will all help hold water back and reduce the impact or the intensity of flooding further downstream.
What about the impact on salmon, Lorraine? When will we know if there's been much of an impact?
Well, right now we're in the middle of the salmon spawning time. So really last week's flood was pretty poor timing. The salmon lay their eggs into the gravel of the riverbed, and they bury the eggs with the gravel, and that is precisely designed to protect the eggs from floods. But of course in big floods you can get movements on the riverbed, and that gravel can be moved downstream, even washed into the sea, and so the eggs can be disturbed and can be lost. We won't really know until next summer when we start surveying for juvenile fish as to what the impact has been on loss of eggs this year. I think we'd probably expect sort of quite a patchy impact. There were some tributaries that really were badly impacted, and we've seen gravel movements on the riverbeds, and they may well have lower fish densities next year as a result. But there'll be other areas of the catchment that have remained pretty unscathed. So yes, it's all about the fish being able to cope with what nature throws at them, but yeah, the challenges coming from nature are getting worse, that's for sure.
What's your thoughts about potentially dredging the river?
Well, dredging really isn't a recommended practice for river management nowadays, and that's because it gets the water off of the land quicker and into the river and just funnels it downstream, creating, you know, an even worse problem downstream. The real solution is to make sure the land is able to hold back the water and not release it all into the river in one go. So the problems that we're seeing are no doubt impacted by the fact that a lot of the side streams in the lowland areas are dredged, so all the water gets quickly funneled into the main stem of the River Dee. And in the uplands, a lot of hill drains and moor drains have been created in the past. And they again just funnel the water very quickly into the upper River Dee.
Lorraine, thank you very much for that. You know, thanks for your insights.
Thanks very much for having me on.
No problem at all there. Dr. Lorraine Hawkins of the River Dee Trust. We've had some comments in about the mystery noise. Karen in Shetlands thought it might be baby peregrine chicks greeting a parent coming home to the nest with their takeaway. No birds a week here yet. There's plenty here.
Yeah. No, I'll do one now. Sorry, I need to wake up. Simon Davies says, good morning to you both from South Uist. Today's sound is just like my first car cassette player chewing up another home-recorded C120 music selection.
And Nigel from Palermo says, loving the cat as always, loving the show as always. You're going to say that the Mr. Sound isn't a cat, but Flynn, our border collie, would strongly disagree. He came galloping downstairs looking for it earlier this morning. Butterfly season has well and truly been and gone. What season there was. But according to experts, more needs to be done right now to protect one of our most threatened species.
Yeah, the northern brown argus is under threat due to habitat loss, and that's mainly caused by the major increase in tree planting in recent years. Now, David Hill is from Butterfly Conservation Scotland, and I met up with him at Alva Glen, where a thriving colony still exists.
It's a small butterfly, so it's a small chocolate brown species, which is about, I don't know, the size of a £2 coin, maybe. So it's not big at all. And it's a northern species, as the name suggests. So it's found in the UK, in Scotland, and in parts of northern England. And it's a species of upland grasslands and species-rich grasslands. It's also found at the coast, but the really important thing is the species-rich or the flower-rich habitats that it needs. It can't survive without these because that's where its food plant, the common rock rose, exists. So the common rock rose plant is the only species that the butterfly caterpillars will eat. So it's really important that species-rich grassland habitats are maintained for the species.
It is rare. What are the numbers like just now?
Well, we don't have too many numbers on its abundance counts, but we do know quite a lot about its distribution. So we know that it's a declining species, so it's declined by about 25% in terms of its range in the UK over the last 30 or 40 years. And those declines are really due to habitat loss and habitat fragmentation.
Now, we decided to meet in a place where they are still found, and they're really loved here, aren't they? There's even a little wooden sculpture trail, and the butterfly features as part of that. Just explain where we are on this wet, miserable day.
Yes, it's proper dreek today. So we are at Alva Glen in the Ochil Hills. In the glen, there's a well-known colony of the butterfly. That colony is counted every year on a week-by-week basis by volunteers who live locally. And those volunteers are also helping conserve the butterfly by managing its habitat in the glen. So the glen's a really special place. There's lots of botanical interests and there's lots of insect interests as well. And the northern brown argus is one of those.
We're just going to take a little walk a bit further up the glen. And you were pointing out, just as we were getting to this area, that this is exactly the kind of species-rich grassland that they need.
Yes, this is exactly what they need. So they love these flower-rich habitats that are full of yarrow and ladies' bedstraw, and of course common rock rose, which is the food plant of the butterfly. Without these kind of valuable habitats, the butterfly simply can't survive.
So these kinds of habitats are disappearing. Why?
Probably the big issue at the moment is tree planting. So there's obviously a really big push by the government to put lots of trees in the ground. For lots of reasons, we'd love to have more woodland cover in Scotland, but it also helps with the fight against climate change. But unfortunately, some of these plantations or newly created areas of woodland are impacting on existing biodiversity. And northern brown argus is one of these things that is often losing out. Because the patches of habitats that it occupies are so small, it's very easy for them to be missed in the surveys that are done before tree planting happens. And the northern brown argus, well, it's a Scottish biodiversity list species, so it's a species that's been identified as a species that's struggling in Scotland and that we should be looking to protect it. So ideally, new woodland creation or tree planting wouldn't happen on species-rich grassland habitat and shouldn't affect the northern brown argus. But unfortunately, we're seeing that more and more, and that's probably what's the biggest kind of impact on the butterfly at the moment in Scotland. Of all the 30-odd species of butterfly that we have in Scotland, probably northern brown argus is one of the top two or three that are struggling.
Is there a solution to that other than don't plant trees in those kinds of areas?
Well, what I would urge is anybody who's thinking about woodland creation or planting trees to get in touch. You can check where common rock rose exists by looking at the National Biodiversity Network websites, or you can get in contact with us at Butterfly Conservation and we can tell you if northern brown argus or common rock rose is known on your site.
Even if people do go ahead and plant trees, you were saying if they could leave strips
of habitat like this that would make a difference?
Yes, it's not about saying we don't want you to plant the entire plantation. The butterfly exists in small little areas, and it's just about identifying those areas and making sure that those are unplanted.
And they exist in quite small colonies, don't they? And they need lots of these little areas move about.
Like lots of other species of insect, and butterfly in particular, they live in what we call metapopulations, so small little colonies that are interlinked. When habitats, even small patches of habitat, gets lost, it affects the whole matrix and it disrupts the butterfly's ability to fly from one patch to another. So that's really disruptive to how the butterfly likes to live, and really, once it starts losing these little patches, the whole system becomes unstable and it's much more likely to die out, unfortunately.
Quite close to here, you mentioned that the northern brown argus had been spotted in an area where it hadn't been seen for 100 years.
Yes, so every year we're learning more and more about the butterfly, and it does seem to have this incredible ability to hold on even when things change a lot. So just along from here, there's a hill on the end of the Ockles called Dumaya, which I'm sure many people will know. It's a very popular walk. Back in the 19th century, Dumaya was known as the place in central Scotland to go and look for northern brown argus. However, it hadn't been seen there in many, many years, perhaps over 100. We certainly don't have any records of the butterfly in the 20th century from Dumaya. And then this year, a lady found an egg of northern brown argus in her garden on some rock rose that she'd planted. And she lives very close to Dumaya, so she went up the hill and she found rock rose on the hill and found northern brown argus eggs on the hill. So it was, great to show that the butterfly still exists at Dumaya. It's probably been there all along. We just didn't know. It's on quite an inaccessible part of the hill where people don't usually go. So, it just shows that this butterfly has this wonderful longevity and it can survive, but we need to help it survive, really.
David Hill from Butterfly Conservation Scotland in Alva Glen. Did you go anywhere this week where the rain wasn't persisting down?
No, I didn't. No. It was lashing everywhere I went. So much so that people were saying, you really want to go ahead with us? Yes, I do. But it's an interesting story, that, isn't it? Because it just illustrates how difficult it is to get the balance right. You know, so many people are trying to do good by planting trees, obviously, and they do a lot of good, obviously. But they're inadvertently destroying some very fragile habitats, and this poor butterfly is suffering as a result.
The law of unintended consequences.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You're listening to Outdoors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stevens, sitting right next to me in front of the fire here at Beechgrove, Rachel Stewart. If you miss any of this, a few ways of listening again.
Yeah, you can catch up whenever you like by looking the programme up on BBC Sounds.
Or you can download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. Tell us where you listen to the podcast, which is what Greg Davis in Lexington, Kentucky did. He says, thank you for your podcast that I've been following faithfully for years. I loved Penny Stewart's radio essay about the shift of summer into autumn and autumn into winter. That was last week and it was excellent. And that's my comments, not his. Especially her focusing upon the seasons changes rather than the calendars.
Yeah, he says that winter walking or hiking is my favourite for many reasons. Among them, the extended golden hours of light, having tracks relatively to myself and no mosquitoes or ticks. He says, my wife and I will be in Orkney this winter for walking, and we can't wait for our return for the first time since 2018. Perhaps we'll see Rachel or Mark out on the trails. With warm regards from the chilly bluegrass of Kentucky, Greg Davis in Lexington. And back to the pressing matter of the mystery sound. Would you like another listen?
Oh, go for it.
Cuts right through you, doesn't it?
Oh, goes right through my lugs, that does. Daniel in Forfar thinks it's young piglets squealing, and Hugh at Montgreenan says, I'm lying in bed listening to your programme, putting off getting a cup of tea. Very wise, man of a certain age. Very appropriate wildlife backing outside here. Tawny hoolets and geese flying over, heading from the Irvine estuary for breakfast. Mystery sound does sound like my pesky grey squirrels. Also, there's a strangled sound in my woods during summer, which I think may be a young buzzard pleading for food. Could easily be, actually, Hugh.
Yeah, Jim of Helensburgh says, I'm sure I've heard this sound when kittiwakes were trying to steal my fish and chips and larks.
Kittiwakes?
Kittiwakes, really? Yeah. Another one here, is it an otter? We've a couple round here and they're pretty noisy, says Ailey in North Skye. And Tammy says, is it a couple of squirrels having a barney?
Could be.
Could be. And Gavin from Bucky says, is today's mystery sound an otter?
See, there's nothing to hang your hat on here. It has to be said, it's a wild shot in the dark, so anybody's guess is as good as anybody else's, basically.
It is.
Give it a go.
Yeah, give it a go. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk is the email address. You can text us 80295 or you can call Finn 08085 92 95 00.
Born in Falkirk in 1899, John Todd was studying medicine when he interrupted his studies to join the Royal Flying Corps, becoming the top Scottish fighter ace of World War I. His grandson, Douglas Curry, reflects here on the achievements of Captain John Todd.
100 years of Scottish stories across 2022 on BBC Radio Scotland.
During his time at the front, he kept a diary in which he recorded, at the end of every day, he recorded the events of the day. There's a particular story I wanted to tell from the entry of 24th of March 1918, at the time of the last big German offensive, when British fighter pilots were redirected from air attack to ground attack, and he was doing a low-level attack on the German front line, and his plane was hit, and he began to lose control, but he was able to direct the plane over the British lines and land in a field some distance behind the British lines, crash-landed, hit a shell hole, turned upside down, and was hanging from his harness, but cut himself out, and then he went in search of help. And as good or bad luck would have it, he ran into an English regiment. When they heard his Falkirk accent, they thought he was German. And so they took him to their headquarters for interrogation. An officer interrogated him and established that he was in fact British, and then let him go. But he had 20 miles to go to get back to his base, and they didn't offer him help. So before going, he asked if he could send a telegram to his base, which he did. And then he walked and hitchhiked for some hours and got back again to his aerodrome. What he didn't realise was that his message hadn't got through. And the base commander sent a telegram to his family in Falkirk and said he was missing in action, presumed dead. And the story in the family is that his mother was going up the stairs that night and saw him coming down. And he said, "Don't worry, Mum, I'm still alive." And the following day, she got a second telegram to say that he was, in fact, alive.
100 years of Scottish stories across 2022. Listen to the stories so far and share your own by heading to bbc.co.uk/radioscotland.
Douglas Curry there and his grandfather, Captain John Todd. If you've got a family story to share, especially one about Christmas or Hogmanay, get in touch via the BBC Radio Scotland website. That's a really, you know, the apparition which appeared to his mother. You hear lots of versions of that, but it's always when somebody's died. Not when somebody hasn't died to say, "Actually, I'm okay, don't worry about it."
Yeah, absolutely. It is a fascinating story. And I think there's a replica of the fighter jet that he flew in Montrose.
Not a fighter jet.
A fighter jet.
World War One fighter jet.
Okay, you're picking me up on my inaccuracies here. I'm sure there is a replica in Montrose, though.
There is.
Yeah, I know.
Exactly the one you're talking about. It's a lovely thing. I was very disappointed to discover it didn't fly.
Did you give it a go, did you?
No. I mean, these things, I mean, literally, it's like wax paper and string. They were extraordinary machines.
Yeah.
We've had some feedback on the mystery noise. Donald Ross says, Saturday morning, beast feeding in progress, just about to head to Dornoch to check some in-calf heifers. Listening to the devastation of the Dee, feel so sorry for these guys who've been so lucky in this corner of Easter Ross. I was thinking the noise was a baby jackdaw, but I'm now wondering if it's a young hare. Cracking show as ever, Saturday mornings, it's hard to leave the tractor cab. Nice to hear it, Donald, thank you.
Ah, Craig in Berstein says, is the distress sound of a fox fighting? Debbie Cameron in Edinburgh says, good morning, chaps. Listening this week from a dry Henley on Thames, the beauty of BBC sounds, visiting the kids. Is the sound happy piglets keeping their trotters crossed that they'll not be drafted in for Christmas dinner?
Oh, steady now. They might be listening. Come on. Many of us look for ways to pass the time during lockdown. For a gentleman called Harvey Patterson, he began to transcribe his mum's diaries from the 1930s, when she was just, I think, about 16 years old. Now, it turns out that despite her youth, his mum, Mary, was a bit of an adventurer on two wheels.
Like most folk, I think, my mother, I do not consider to be remarkable at all, but she turned out to... I've had a very remarkable bike journey at the age of 16 in 1935.
Where did she go?
She left here. This is Hartwood Hill Estate near Shotts. And she went with her two sisters who were a bit older, maybe 10 years older, on a bike tour to eventually Skye. They got as far as Uig and Skye, and it was during the Glasgow Fair fortnight.
So they basically just jumped on their bikes from here and headed north?
Yes. They left here, I imagine, at the crack of dawn in 1935 and ended up at Creanlarich.
Where did they stay?
At a succession of SYHA youth hostels. The SYHA was founded in 1931, mm-hmm. after the German model, and the hostels became very popular because in those days people were beginning to learn how to get out of the industrial areas in the big cities and exercise.
I mean, the great thing about the youth hostels was they were cheap, they were safe, they were reasonably regularly spaced. So, I mean, they were a huge... If you didn't want to camp, that was the way to do it.
Oh, yes, that was the way to do it. There was one instance, one overnight they had with an uncle, I think, and another night they had maybe a CTC place, Cyclist Touring Club.
Yes, aye.
But the CTC and the SYHA between them provided a huge range, I think, quite quickly too, of accommodation.
It was a sort of fantastic sort of democratisation of the countryside, because it meant that people who were not well off, you know, who were not from the European touring classes, could actually get out and explore their own country.
Yes, that is. I agree with that entirely. The cheapness helped. I don't know what it cost my mother for an overnight stay, but I have an SYHA handbook from 1966. Uh-huh. And in those days, I can't remember whether it was £2.06 or £3 a night for an adult, and a lot less for a youngster.
Yeah, precisely. You know a lot of this because she wrote it in a wee book. I don't suppose by any chance you've got it with you.
Oh, yes, I have it here.
What? That is a very small book.
Yes. Now, I'm turning to the opening page. Uh-huh. There you are, 1935, 6th to 18th July.
Tour in Northwest. Left home at 7 a.m. Glasgow, along Edinburgh Road, Annisland Cross, then Main Boulevard to Balloch. Lovely day, very warm. Had tea at Luss. Isn't that lovely? And it's written in pencil. But fantastic to have that.
Oh, yes. I always knew that I had it. But during the initial lockdown in March 2020, I thought, well, what to do? And so I took this notebook and transcribed the whole thing, a bit at a time. And what you're looking at, the tour in the Northwest Highlands and Skye, the transcription went to Carol and Lorna, husband and wife team, who run the Port Charlotte hostel in Isla. And Carol looked at it and thought, we could do something with this. And so the marketing people in SYHA were involved, and eventually they incorporated it last year in their commemoration handbook for 2021. The point being that the hostels were formed in 1931, so they were 90 years old last year.
Yeah. And your mum, did she keep up the cycling habit throughout her life?
Oh, yes, she cycled till she was about, I would say, maybe 62 or 63. Uh-huh. And then she had to give up because she developed curvature of the spine.
Okay.
Lost several inches off her height.
Yes.
And that was it. Yeah. However, for some reason, and I'm not too sure what that reason was, for some reason in 1993-94 approximately, I decided to take up the bike again. You see, I gave up the bike when I was 17 because I became, can I put it this way, old enough to be different. And so from, I would say, 1964 through to 1994, I was not on a bike at all.
Okay. And what put you back on the bike in 1994?
I've been wondering about that, and I'm not at all sure. A friend encouraged me, I think, because he had a spare bike. Having said that, I have been cycling now continually, more or less winter as well as summer, from 1994-1995.
And do you tend just to go out and runs, or do you do the touring thing too? Do you stay away?
I've never been that fit, I feel, for long-distance cycling. Perhaps it would have been different had I been cycling all my life. But I tend to do a mixture of cycling with the local U3A, University of the Third Age, group based in Lanark, where I live.
It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because, I mean, there's your mother in the 1930s, and her way of escaping, of exploring, was on a bicycle. And then there was a long, long period where the bicycle was the poor man's friend, essentially. You know, and now it's coming back into vogue again. More and more people are seeing the advantages. I mean, you know, not just the sort of health benefits, but the environmental benefits of jumping on a bike and actually exploring.
Oh, yes, yes. There's a bewildering array of or choice of bikes nowadays. I really don't know what they all are.
Can I ask you a personal question? How old are you?
I'm 76.
What would you say to somebody, also 76, who said, you know, I haven't cycled in years, I'd quite like to take it back up again? Would you advise it or put them off it? What would you do?
Oh, I would try to encourage them as much as I could. The simple reason being that, well, it's only a personal view, but I feel that at the age of 76, cycling, especially on a flat road, is easier than walking.
Harvey Patterson with some wise words that cycling can be easier than walking, and also reminiscing on his mother Mary's cycling achievement. Actually, earlier this year, a group called the Adventure Syndicate, a group of female cyclists, undertook a trip from Glasgow to Skye, and they were inspired by Mary Harvey.
Yeah, I think that's a really lovely little story, isn't it? We were just looking at a picture of her notebook and her fabulous writing, all done in pencil.
Yeah, no, really sort of copper plate writing and things.
Yeah, there's lovely.
Coming up March next year, I think it's March 23, will be the 100th anniversary of the BBC in Scotland. And we want to do something to try and celebrate it, but we're sort of having an argument amongst ourselves about what might actually constitute a celebration. We're open to ideas. You know, we'd quite like ideas. Something that just kind of marks the passing of the year, something that might make sense. Maybe the youth hostling thing we could work into it some. I don't know. But, you know, it's a white page at the moment. Please write on it. You can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Any ideas you have that might work for celebrating 100 years of the BBC in Scotland?
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll get some cracking ideas. We can always count on our listeners, can't we?
Well, hopefully.
wake
up, yeah.
We've had a comment in from Michael Manor in Orkney. He says, in relation to trees still being in leaf at this time of year, I'm temporarily in Orkney and there are blackbirds nesting in the bush outside my window and daffodils poking out of the ground here. Yeah, that sounds very unusual.
Let's go back. We were talking earlier about Denmark Field on the outskirts of Perth. It's about a 90-acre rewilding site, which you visited in pea and rain again.
Absolutely. It was lashing. Many wildlife experts agree that ponds and scrapes can play a vital role in creating valuable habitats. So one of the first things that they did there when they began their project a year and a half ago was to create a scrape, and already the benefits have been remarkable. Ecologist Ellie Corsi explains a bit more.
A few weeks ago we had somebody from Bug Life who came and had a look at our scrapes, and that was just a week after they started filling up with water for the wet season. And the lady that came found beetle larvae, black fly larvae and mayfly larvae in the water already, and the water had only been there for a few days. I don't quite know how it works, but the water appears and then all of a sudden all of the insects just appear. It's amazing.
So you've got one big scrape here and you've got quite a few smaller ones surrounding that one. Why did you decide to create them?
This site is on the floodplain of the Tay, so it's perfect for creating wet habitats. And we've kind of looked at the lay of the land and found the kind of low points in the landscape, and any areas that have got a lot of kind of clay content in the soil are perfect for retaining water. So we've kind of identified those areas and created these wetlands, and that just introduces a completely different habitat here and allows us to support biodiversity that we wouldn't be able to support if we didn't have these wet habitats.
How do we describe the scrape? I mean, it looks like a mini pond, but it's not permanent, is it?
Yeah, so scrapes are kind of intermittently wet habitats. So generally they hold water through the winter, and then in the kind of middle of the summer, they'll mostly be dry or just kind of boggy. And these habitats are really rare now. Generally, people only like open water. So if you're going to create a pond, people will generally create a pond with really kind of steep edges and lots of very deep open water, because that's what we think looks beautiful. But actually, these kind of intermittently wet habitats that are really vegetated are amazing for insects and really, really rare now.
And with shallow sides, so that creatures can get in and out quite easily.
Definitely, yeah. So the shallow sides are amazing for allowing creatures to get in and out, but they're also really good because they provide areas where aquatic vegetation can grow. And if you have a lot of kind of intermediate habitat in between the dry land and the wetland, that's where you get the most number and diversity of plant species. So if you make a really gradual gradient between the dry area and the wet area, you'll get loads of different types of plants, and then you'll get lots of different types of insects, and then you get lots of different types of birds.
And this is being topped up nicely today because it's been raining all morning. There is no permanent water supply here though, you're just relying on runoff.
Yeah, so because we've kind of picked this low point in the landscape, there are kind of higher areas all around us, and the water that gathers here is just coming from runoff from the land around.
So you've mentioned some of what you've seen already. What else have you managed to note over the last few months or since you created them?
So we've had quite a lot of birds that have been attracted to this area, to this water source, and also mammals that have been coming at night to drink from here. We've just recently seen that badgers and deer come down to the water and sometimes drink at night, which is amazing. And then, yeah, we've had these aquatic invertebrates just appearing so quickly when the scrape has filled up. And then, of course, that attracts lots of other wildlife. So we've had lots of birds here. We've got a volunteer, a very dedicated volunteer called Mike, who comes every single Tuesday morning. And he's seen lots of birds, such as greylag, geese and snipe and pied wagtails, and even a heron. And those birds are unlikely to be seen if we didn't have this wet habitat here. A couple of weeks ago, I came down here and I saw three dragonflies for the first time. And that was the first time that we'd ever recorded dragonflies on this site. So that's really exciting. We saw three common darters, and two of them were actually mating and laying eggs in one of these wetlands. So if we didn't create these wetlands, this site would not have the potential to have that species. So it's already had a massive impact on biodiversity.
We're just looking in the water itself. Is there much growing here?
Yeah, there's loads of plants already appearing. So these scrapes were created about a year ago, and already we've got lots of plants that have started colonising. It'll take a really long time for a good diversity of aquatic plants to come here kind of naturally, but we've already had lots of plants coming in, and as you can see, there's lots of plants that are starting to colonise even the bottom of the scrape already.
And some willow as well, and you think that will be really valuable in the future for providing some shade?
Yeah. This area of land is an ex-arable field, so there's a lot of nutrients in the soil, and that nutrients isn't always good for wet habitat. Sometimes it can cause algal blooms in the summer periods or on really sunny days. So yeah, we're looking forward to more trees and scrub developing around the edges of the scrape, and that will provide shade, which will kind of reduce the chance of these kind of algal blooms.
What would you say to people who are considering doing something like this? Do you think it's a big boost to wildlife and nature?
Definitely. We historically have had a really bad relationship with water on the land, and I think generally we've just tried to get water off the land as quickly as possible and make it the next landowner's issue downstream from us. And we're kind of recognising now that by creating wetlands, we're benefiting wildlife, and there's lots of other benefits as well. We can reduce the flood risk downstream and capture carbon in these wetlands. So it's really important that we have more and more landowners coming forward and looking into creating wet habitats like these.
That was Ellie Corsi there, Rewilding Denmark Field.
Yeah, in the rain.
As ever.
Time now to reveal our mystery sound. Will we hear it again?
Just one more time.
One more time.
It's a right piercing sound. I don't know why, but I mean, Ben McGregor got it right. He says, I reckon they're pine martens. I had them in the log cabin in the wood a few years ago when the mother gnawed her way in and left her two half-grown kits in one of the corners.
Absolutely. Loads of right answers here to Fred Godden in Armadale, Trish, Leslie Body in Methlick, Pamela and Alan in Edinburgh, Margaret McAlpine, Lorna McGregor in Dull, and John McKenzie in Orkney, all saying pine marten. John saying, is it an amorous pine marten?
Well, that we don't know. Their cause is not ours. Colin and Mary Abercrombie in Dunblane got it correct, as did Marion and Kinross, Scott and Nadia from Bothwell. And basically a comment here saying, hi Finn, well there you go, it says, I think today's mystery sound is a pine marten. Could also be something similar like mink or polecat, but I'll go for pine marten. Congratulations on your Open Times job, welcome to our area, a good move. And that's from Ross and Tainalt.
That's lovely,
isn't it? Not to us, to Finn.
No, to Finn, yeah, we've been bypassed.
Too straight, yesterday's people. When the team were planning a trip recently to the Cowell Peninsula, as if by magic, this type of coincidence occasionally happens, it's lovely, came from the Strachar Smiddy with an invitation to visit it, because it now, it's an 18th century smiddy, but it now operates as a museum. I love that kind of stuff, so we thought, cracking.
Absolutely. As you can imagine, Mark was in his element in the company of Cathy Montgomery and Patrick Gibb.
Gee, I love this. You've actually got the fire going in the forge and all of these tools here. Are these tools original?
Yes, these are the original tools, and I think that, as far as I understand it, when the smiddy fell out of use in the 1950s, it was used as a shed, things were just left, and then when these ladies reinvigorated it in the late 90s, everything was found, and there was a very well-known blacksmith, Ian Wade, who had been a judge at the Highland Show during the horseshoe competitions, and he came along. Mm-hmm. And on our website, you can see a video of him talking about the tools and what they were for. Mm-hmm.
We had obviously started clearing out the smiddy. So 1993 mm-hmm. was that first meeting in the Memorial Hall to see if there was any interest in making the smiddy into a museum. Yes, we started. So we were already clearing. One day, Ian appeared at the smiddy door. Is this another smiddy becoming a house? Ian was here for 10 years. He helped us to clear out, told us what to throw out, told us what to keep, and cleaned the tools. You would see all that in the wee video. Every year we had to fundraise. We needed 6 events once we were up and running. So Ian came twice a year at a horseshoeing demonstration, beginning of the season and then the end of the season.
Just talk me through some of this, because obviously, you know, you can recognise a bog standard anvil and things like that, but there is an enormous lump of something there. It looks like a sort of Dutchman's shoe.
Swage block.
What's that for?
It's for bending things, bending and shaping things. I think you basically take a piece of hot metal and you hammer it into the undulations there to produce bends and twists and things.
You see, for example, that fits into this part of the anvil.
Mm-hmm. So the anvil has a square hole.
Okay.
And it's got lots of tools that fit in there. And you could, again, hit some hot metal in there.
They all fit in. So it was to shape the metal. It's got a nice sound. Give it a wee clang yourself.
I'll give it a go. Again, there's just something about that, isn't there? I haven't even hit it yet. It bounces.
And Ian was a left-hander, so the anvil had to be turned around for him as being a left-hander.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah. I find this fascinating because I'm almost clinically addicted to tools. You know, it just, you know, I see stuff and I go, ooh, what's that for? I've just caught sight of your bellows. I'm tripping over the lazy blacksmith. These are enormous.
They're enormous, yes.
Do they still work?
Absolutely. In fact, they're essential.
And of course, this is for children coming in. Oh, they'll love it. Not just children, of course. So, the old bellows, of course, the original bellows, It's the original wood, but new leather work was put in when we had all the work done. And this,
you can see the fire actually blowing up here. Listen to this. See, that's extraordinary. Even when you stopped pumping it, it was still blowing.
This is a 2-year pipe, and the air is going through this pipe here.
I tell you, this is some workout. I was watching people, obviously watching not from within the gym, but there's a gym in Dunoon. I was watching them last night thinking, that looks hard work. This looks harder.
Yes, I think that is very true. You just have to watch the blacksmiths at work in the old photos of the shoeing. Heavy, heavy
it's
work.
It's the hands and the forearms.
And the weight of metal, some of that stuff there is amazing.
Like the cart jack I've actually seen in use.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I have a book dated 1950, which is a book written for an apprentice blacksmith telling you how to become a blacksmith. Yeah. And the first thing it talks about is how to set up your workshop, your forge, and it says, get an electric fan. they're cheap and they make such a difference. So we're obviously pre-1950s in our technology.
How much of a social hub was this place?
Of course, this was the main road. And folks coming up the Bray would be always coming in here, children going to school, people bringing their animals, of course, their horses. There's the old, old shoes from these times in here. Absolutely the hub of the community, the warmth of the fire attracting people in, and just the meeting place and the chat and the crack, all of that. Absolutely, it was the centre of the community.
Why did you want to renovate this place? Why did you want to get it back in, as it was?
You know, our father used to talk about it. And he always fancied a tea room here. So that was in my mind too, truth to tell. Just the history of it and growing up with father's stories meant a lot to us, of course.
The blacksmith, I mean, it's difficult to see other than, say, the doctor or the minister, a character in any village or town that was more central than the blacksmith, because essentially it was Mr. DIY. He could fix absolutely anything.
You are right, absolutely. They were the key person in the community. The horses, of course, were the means of transport needed. The horses need the power. So you can understand why the blacksmiths were. So in here in our parish, one at Pole, Strachar, Strathlachlan, and just in our wee 3 miles... diameter stretch, There's a tool over here, and I wonder if you know what this is.
I do, as a matter of fact. I do. That's for that's a leather worker's tool. And you put this piece of metal in there and then stitch it. It's basically, it's like a long pair of eyebrow tweezers. And by long, I mean it's made of wood, but it's about 3 feet long nearly.
So Dick the Saddler is part of our childhood. And in his elder later years, in fact, he almost ended his years with us staying in our house. He was from Kilsyth. So he made the belt for our house, which I'd rather still got, and our first school bags. Dick the Saddler did that for us.
When you say the belt for your house, as in sort of a
toz. It hung behind the door. It was never used, truth to tell.
You disappoint me. It's such a wonderful thing that you all got together and kept this existing.
Yes, and it means so much to so many people. It's wonderful.
Cathy Montgomery and Patrick Gibb of the Strachar Smiddy. If you're in the area, it's slightly off the main drag. I cannot tell you how worth a visit is. And if you get the chance to actually get some of the Smiddy cake, which is for sale occasionally, it is cracking. It's very, very good.
We are hungry now. And I don't know if you can hear the sizzling of the bacon in the background.
The bacon burning nicely.
Fantastic. Andy's been in touch to say he's tuning in on the way north to Nethy Bridge for a trustee meeting with the outdoor charity Abernethy Trust, a charity that connects young and old to all the outdoors has to offer. He says, great to be listening live for once.
Excellent. Well, no, fine. Now, well, there's been a lot of stuff on the programme this week, a lot of it extremely damp.
Most of it
extremely damp. You were extremely damp for most of it.
Yeah, I'm still just drying out.
Yeah, I know. It was that piece at Burnbanks. Don't forget our New Scotland Outdoors podcast available today at noon, and our midweek podcast on Wednesday, also at noon, featuring a Perthshire Estates approach to deer management. It was a really interesting discussion, that. From all the team here, thanks for listening.